You know, there are all kinds of interesting people who live right around your neighborhood. Like, oh, the publicist, the rights distribution manager.
Would you look at that? It's People in Your Neighborhood on 95BFM. Thanks to APRA AMCOS NZ.
Oh, hi there.
Shh, listen.
It's putting us in the right mood.
That's Boogie Monday, right?
Yeah, that is Subwear with Disco Hoopla. And I'd like to welcome Joost Logan. Oh, no, Loganveld.
Oh, we tried it so hard before, right? Oh, God. So good. Hey, thank you for having me.
Maybe you can pronounce it a little bit better than I can.
Joost.
Joost. Yeah. Hi, Joost. How's it going?
I'm going really good.
That's good.
So happy to be here.
I'm so happy to have you here.
Oh, that's so good. So coming home, I used to spend quite a bit of time up here. And last decade, or maybe the one before, a while ago.
So the Tuesday 2 to 4.
I think it was a Tuesday, Wednesday. I can't quite remember. It's quite a long time ago.
Yeah. But at the moment, you're running Big Pop Studios.
Yeah. So
amongst other things.
Amongst other things, but everything's kind of connected to the studios. The studios are kind of the heart of it, and it's a physical space.
Yeah.
And some of the other things are a little bit more idea spaces, mind spaces. Yeah,
that's cool. Yeah. So for the audience, I guess most people would be familiar with places like The Lab and Roundhead, which are recording spaces for bands and musicians and things like that. But Big Pop is a bit different, isn't it?
It's a little bit different, yeah. I mean, it has the same kind of attributes, so you can record anything you want. It also has a commercial side of it, which kind of helps pay for the
idea side.
Yeah, for the idea side, exactly. So we do some post-production, which taps into some TV and advertising work.
Yep.
We also do quite a bit of production work for the global fitness industry, which basically pays the rent.
Yeah.
So that's, and then beyond that, there's artists that come in that we kind of mentor and work with in a label sense, and a publishing side that goes with that as well.
Yeah, so lots of things.
Yeah, lots of things.
Okay, so can we start off with post-production?
Yeah, sure.
Can you explain to us what post-production is?
Yeah, post-production is really the mixing of environments. So like you have two picture, generally speaking. So like it's like it's doing sound design, it's doing voiceover, and Atmos, what they call Atmos, which is really the noise of a room. Like we're sitting here, for example, and there's drilling outside. It's finding all those sounds and putting those together. So post-production is all that. And Foley as well, which is really, someone walks in, footsteps and rustling of clothes.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so you can go real deep on that.
Yeah.
I personally don't do that much of that.
I mean,
my history is more on the writing of the music, so composing or...
Yeah,
whacking beats together or whatever. Yeah.
So with post production, you might just get like a little film or an ad, and they go, "We want this voice to say this."
Yeah.
And we want this sound, and you do all that audio to go with that.
And then it gets mixed. Yeah, there's sort of different levels for TV, for radio. So there's some technical aspect to it that you have to conform to. have it allowed to be played. Yeah.
What's like your when you actually have done like sound effects? What's the most interesting thing you've ever, what noise or instrument you've ever had to do?
many years ago, I worked with a person called Victoria Kelly on a movie called The Irrefutable Truth About Demons, which was a kind of crazy horror movie, and we did water balloons around and recorded those, and
kind
of make textures and stretching rubber bands and slowing them down. So it can be heaps of fun.
So for the music composition for films and things, I'm quite naive about how that works. Like, I remember when I was a kid seeing Chariots of Fire, and I think the video to it is the guys running along the beach, and then there's this orchestra just kind of looking up at the film, like really concentrating, and then playing the music. Is that what it's like when you're writing music?
I guess in a really ideal setting, it could be that way.
Yeah.
I think most of the time you kind of... It's sort of a collaborative effort, for starters. So you're part of a team, director, producers, kind of other people that have some input on the creative. So there's discussion of what it could be or should be, and you can put in your 50 cents at that point. And then beyond that, you're going to go through the movie and spot all the bits that want music or want sound.
Because it really makes a difference, doesn't it?
I think it does.
I was talking to someone recently, and we're talking about horror movies and about when you're really, really scared, if you turn the music off.
it just looks ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's some quite interesting clips, you know, YouTube ones that where people kind of put really inappropriate music with movies like that.
Like the Benny Hill thing.
Yeah, like rom-com style. It really, changes the energy and the mood. Yeah, so much. It has such a big influence on it.
Yeah, but you're being like quite modest because you've actually won awards and things.
I have won awards. How did you know that?
Did a bit of research.
Yeah, I'll Google.
What awards and what movies have you like?
Now I have to go back because you've probably got it written down, but I can't even remember the name of the movie that I won it for because it's a what? It was a road movie. It was really cool, and I did it with a guy called Leighton, so we collaborated on that together, and it was we won the best film score.
That's awesome.
In 2000 and something.
Oh, yeah.
2000, not much. 2000 and not much.
2000 and not much.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was a Gillian Ashurst film. And it was...
Oh, but look at like the TV composition, Beyond the Dark Lens.
Yeah.
Police 10-7, that's one of my favourite shows.
Boy.
But also, you've had you've worked on lots of different projects, like musicians and things like that.
Yeah. And in actual fact, I mean, even Police 10-7, they all date back a while. So I haven't really done a lot of that. My role sort of changed a lot more.
So are you more looking at the ideas?
Yeah, I guess I've sort of become a little bit more of a mentor to people.
Yeah.
So I help people with the production, also with their kind of ideas. Their art, how to... Yeah, define it, refine it, distill it into something that is tangible for an audience. So I talk shit basically all day long.
I'm sure you don't. Can you talk a little bit about the artists that you work with? Because our listeners will be familiar.
Yeah, well, I mean, the one that's sort of getting a lot of love at the moment, and thanks to the BNet as well, is Chai. We've been working with Chai for 5 years, 6 years or something like that.
Yeah. And how do you, what do you look for when you start working with someone? Like, what is the kind of specialness that you see that you go, woohoo?
That's interesting, right? It's I think it's actually just whether you kind of get a person or like a person. I think it's a very human relationship. Yeah, I mean, no one really wants to work with people, no matter how talented, if they're horrible. Totally. So I think that's the first thing is really that. And with Chai, for example, I mean, for the first few years she was making videos and just kind of hanging out and not really doing a hell of a lot of music.
Yeah She's fantastic.
Yeah, she's so cool.
If people haven't listened to her music, you should, definitely. And the videos are stunning.
She's super talented. I mean, and that's really my initial kind of work with her was all video based. She was shooting stuff for other people we work with and doing some promo stuff. And she's a great producer, director, individual field as well. Yeah.
Huh. And what? How did the label start? What's the name of the label?
Oh, so the label is there are two labels.
Yep.
One of them is called Black Lotus, which is the label that Chai's with, which is a little bit more. Which is kind of everything, a catch-all for everything. And then there's another label called Marigold, which is ambient, textural, almost meditative.
Is that like sit at home, put the candles on?
Pretty much, yeah.
Can't
go to sleep.
Yep.
Put one of those on.
That sounds really awesome. Yeah. So how do you fit this all in?
I'm not too sure. It just happens.
Organically.
Yeah, organically.
Yeah.
And it sort of fits around other things.
It's
not that hard. Yeah.
So for the listeners, can you tell people some of the artists, or some of the bands, if I can call them that loosely, you've been in? Because there's a lot and they're very, very famous.
Ooh, that's a bit cool.
Well, they are.
Yeah. I have to go back quite a long way. How far do you want me to go back?
I think in the beginning.
In the beginning.
In the beginning.
Well, in the beginning, I sort of, my high school years, I spent with Paul Cassidy and Greg Johnson in a band.
Yep.
Which I'm not allowed to ever utter the name.
Aren't you?
Paul Cassidy would kill me. but that band kind of grew into, both a Greg Johnson solo career, Greg Johnson set, and Straw People.
Yep.
So that was kind of the foundation of that. which actually all ties in with BFM, because even, 1985 is probably when Straw People first mucked around here in the studio and started making the first, the bones of the first album.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
And then later, I went overseas for a while and then came back and hooked up with Eddie Chambers, and we set up Nemesis Dub Systems, which was also... Most of the music was recorded here at the BFM studios as well.
At that time, those musical projects were way ahead of their time.
I don't know, maybe.
I
can't be too objective about it and too close.
I kind of feel like that was in the midst of a whole lot of guitar stuff. And you were working with electronics, which was really different at the time.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we tied in some live bass, some live guitar, but it was essentially... touches of acid house and dubby stuff, and a bit of guitar, a bit of indie stuff. So it was a beautiful culture clash between K-Road indie kids, and more urban and clubby vibes. So it was sort of a weird hybrid of that.
And amazing vocalists in Straw People.
Absolutely, Straw People is amazing. It was a huge white. And actually, they're recording new material at the moment at the studio. So,
are you part of that?
I'm doing a few little bits. They kind of, it's Paul and Fiona who joined the project primarily.
And can you tell us a little bit about the Flying Nun NRA?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the same time, the late 80s, early 90s were really kind of quite a crazy time for me. And I kind of really learned a lot about myself musically. I was in Nemesis Dub Systems. I was still doing some session work and some live playing with Greg. I was part of the Greg Johnson set for a little bit. And then I was in a band called NRA, not really anything. There was also a lot of activity around a label at the time called Deep Grooves, which was, for me, a very transformative period where more hip-hop styles or more urban styles really start to fuse into contemporary music, and being made here. A lot of it was coming from overseas, but actually.
So had you kind of like been exposed to that overseas and kind of brought those ideas back?
I can't claim that. I mean, it was definitely around. And one thing I used to love a lot and still do is I've always been surrounded by people who are incredibly passionate about music, and I love music, but there's people who love music more than I do. I do love the technology of making music. Other people really just really get real deep and into genres and subgenres and So at that time, Eddie was one of those people. Stinky Jim was one of those.
Yep.
That at that point were super transformative in introducing me to music that I'd never heard before. Dominic Nola, there's a whole bunch of people.
That's so cool.
Later on, people like Roger Perry, Daryl, DLT, there was a lot of people.
Because you've worked with many, many people.
All those people here.
And True Bliss,
yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about that? I saw that.
I know, right?
It's quite funny. It's like the second one on the audio culture.
Oh, really? Oh, boy.
First one is Straw People, second one is True Bliss.
Well, I guess it's the biggest one I've ever been involved with in terms of... charting or sales.
Did you write the music?
No, I didn't write the music. I kind of produced or definitely co-produced the music. So,
And
it was one of those kind of weird, I call them fortunate events. In the theme of Lemony Snicket. So it was one of those kind of things. I was broke ass. Totally broke ass. Someone came to me say, "Here's some money for this crazy TV show idea. We want you to produce the music. Can we use you and some of your gear and." And Anthony's going to come write songs. So, okay, cool. Let's do that. And it kind of got me out of a pickle, paid my rent for literally a few months at the time.
What was it like working on a project like that?
I was crazy. I was kind of a little bit shielded because obviously I spent a lot of time in the studio kind of while people weren't there. But the sugar rush around it was insane.
I guess for people who don't know, True Bliss was essentially a television show where they chose, was it five women?
Five
women to become like a girl pop group. Was they before the Spice Girls or post?
I think the Spice Girls were just around, and I think the idea was sort of modelled on... See, the Spice Girls weren't really part of a TV show, but I think it was almost like, let's find our own Spice Girls kind of vibe.
And at the time, it was like quite phenomenal, wasn't it?
Well, the whole show sort of became a blueprint for what is now X Factor and all the singing shows and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which was kind of in a weird way, even though, I mean, musically I've always been very left of center. The extreme opposite of that, right? Which makes it ironically really funny to me. But it is one of those, fortunate events. I was pretty lucky as well that the very first show that went to air, they used a song by pop music by.
Oh, yep.
And they hadn't cleared the license, so obviously they got the call from whoever is the boss of that, and they said, "Hey, if you want to use it next week, it's going to cost you $10,000 or something like that, or whatever. Yeah, some big sum of money."
Yep.
So they came to me in a rush, said, "Oh, we need a new theme song, so
one that sounds like this, but not so much that it sounds like that."
So I wrote that and produced it basically in an afternoon.
Yeah.
But it ended up traveling a lot, so the royalties ended up being quite good. And it was really my segue from doing jobs for money and doing jobs, non-music related jobs for money. I used to do many other things to actually become the transition and become a full-time music making human.
It's really difficult, and it was harder, I guess, in a way back then, because there were few and far between, weren't they? Like you couldn't, it was really, you kind of had to go overseas to become a working musician
in a way,
without having another job.
Absolutely.
In New Zealand. Yeah.
And people still, it's really, I don't know, there's an aspect of elitism about being able to afford to be a musician at the moment that I think is not a great.
I hate elitism.
Yeah, well, totally. So I find that quite sad. Well, quite sad. It's just the state
it's,
of
it's
state
disappointing.
Of the world. It's disappointing.
Because we should all be working as a team to help each other.
Absolutely. And I kind of think a lot about why that is. And a lot of it is the fact that rents are insanely high, commercial rent, creative spaces that used to be around quite a lot. I remember I spent a lot of time at Incubator Studios, for example, on Upper Simon Street. And it was a great space, and I don't think the rent was crazy money, but it allowed societal rejects like us to hang out and basically make music and experiment and fail and win occasionally. Yeah.
And all those studios like created a scene and hangers-on.
Yeah.
Like I can think of lots of spaces where I would have just been sitting in a corner going, whoa.
Yeah, totally. Right.
This is awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I can't play an instrument, but, you need your fans and your, to buy the music and go to the shows and all that kind of thing.
Absolutely, yep. And Incubator was very much like that. It was sort of the Headless Chickens, quite a bit of Degrow stuff, NRA, all those families, musical families were kind of hanging out there, and it was the kind of headquarters for that.
Yep.
Later on, Unitone Hi-Fi sort of grew a little bit from Nemesis, Stinky joined,
Wow, that's good. Where were you playing, and with, say, Unitone Hi-Fi? What kind of venues?
Well, Unitone was kind of was an odd one, because Unitone didn't really kick off until about 92. We did some recorded stuff, and then I moved to the States in 92. So it was like it became this weird long distance kind of sort of working relationship where basically we would fax across the ocean and sit.
Pre-internet,
absolutely.
Pre-1995,
Now, we used to have internet, but only just.
Yeah.
I remember having internet in New York, and it was like, there weren't many websites, and one of them was the space agency, NASA one, where you could download photos from space.
That's cool.
Which was pretty cool. But they literally used to take days to actually manifest on your screen.
15 hours.
Yeah, totally. Or
15 days waiting. Yeah.
So basically communicated by faxes and courier DATs, DAT tapes.
Yeah.
Here's some ideas, or here's some samples, or here's a vocal a cappella you can use for something. And that sort of extended actually in the third Bronx. It was New Zealand, New York, and in Germany, where a guy called Mark Grimwood, who was program director here in the late 80s, set up a record label called Incoming, and Unitone was signed to Incoming. So we were released in Germany music was made.
Wow, that's cool.
Weirdly, internationally. Yeah.
Yeah. So did you tour?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did a big European tour. So like France, Germany, Holland. Played a show in the UK as well. So it gets...
So that would have been the height of rave as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, actually it's a little bit later. It was kind of the height of trip-hop, kind of in a way.
Oh, yep,
it was, that was kind of... the tour was sort of 96, 97.
Yeah.
And then we did a couple of crazy shows in Auckland when we were all in the same place, which was in 97. There's a snooker hall on K Road, sort of opposite Verona.
Yep.
Basement place. And that used to be a Chinese restaurant before it became a pool hall. And the person who had the lease on it is someone I used to work for in a restaurant many years prior.
Yeah.
And it was a place in transition, was empty. And so we did some crazy raves in there. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Was there like...
highly illegal, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah.
I think I only went to like maybe two... when I was quite young. One was in Williamson Ave, but I definitely didn't go to one in a Chinese restaurant.
Right, yeah.
But I wish I did.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
So much fun. So like out of all the pies that you've got your fingers in,
yes,
what do you think is your favourite?
At the moment or in the past or
just in general?
I just really like hanging out with people. I really love the process of doing stuff. I don't care too much what happens once it's done. I really like being in a room with people, bouncing ideas, maybe contributing a little bit or just listening. At the moment, I'm really enjoying listening. I sort of really feel there's a lot of transitions in the world, COVID, BLM, gender, you name it, there's so many, and there's so much for... I feel I can contribute some, but it's a lot for me to learn as well. So it's kind of my happy place is kind of there.
I think like the best creativity comes out of when you don't expect something at the end.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Because really, as an artist or even as a label or as a publisher, you've really got very little control of what happens. Yeah, it's so timing, messaging, image, all those things are kind of, you can do so much, but sometimes you do very little and you can achieve just as much. As well, but but you have very little control over that. The bits you can control are the ones hanging out with people, doing things, making things as good as they can be on the day.
That's so cool.
Well,
thank you so much for coming out.
Oh, you're
today.
Welcome.
I've
so
really
nice to
enjoyed
be here.
Having you on the show.
Oh, thank you.
Gonna play One Spirit from Unitone Hi-Fi, which is yourself and Stinky Jim.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yeah, and Angus McNaughton pokes his head in on occasion.
Now, this one's got strings in it. Is that right?
I'm not too sure if it's got strings in this one.
I think it's the one I chose.
It's got live brass.
Oh, yeah, cool. Because I was just like, wow, this is awesome. Oh, yeah, no, I was thinking of the other one that I really liked, which I'll ask you about off
air. Cool. Yeah, good. Sounds good.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Let's listen to One Spirit.
Another friendly face to make life a little richer. People in your neighbourhood on 95BFM. Thanks to APRA AMCOS NZ.